Hi, I'm David Herron. Welcome to the Wilton & Bain podcast series, Outside the Boardroom. In this series, we interview CEOs and leaders about their personal stories, helping to humanise the mythical art of leadership. I'm excited to share these stories as we unpack the motivations and drivers that have helped these amazing people to build their careers. In this episode, I'm joined by Wayne Levings. Wayne has worked all over the world and currently sits as the Chief Client Officer and the CEO of North America for Kantar. Wayne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, David. Great to be here with you.
So yeah, why don't you take us back to the beginning then? It'd be great to know how this journey all started and how you've sort of ended up here, really.
Sure. I started my career in South Africa and joined Procter & Gamble at an interesting time in that business because of, in the 90s, apartheid was dismantling in South Africa at the time, and a lot of multinational companies had boycotted South Africa because of sanctions at the time. And P&G returned to South Africa in the mid-90s, and I was, at the time, actually quite fortunate enough to be part of the initial intake of graduates out of university into P&G. So you were joining this very large US multinational as it came back into South Africa, but at a time when you were sort of like graduate number three. So it was a good time to join because you got lots of exposure, you saw parts of the business and got involved in things that you wouldn't have normally done. And if I joined, for example, in any other market in the world, in the UK or the US, you just wouldn't have got that exposure. So it was a lovely time to join that business. And Procter is, as many people know, just a wonderful foundational company to join. If you want to have a career in management, if you want to have a career in sales and marketing, P&G is just one of the best places to be at in terms of both the way they train, the ethos, their focus, etc. So I had about 7 wonderful years at P&G, initially in South Africa, doing a variety of roles, both on the brand side and on the sales side, working in Johannesburg and Cape Town. And then in the early 2000s, in fact, let's say late 99, I got the opportunity to be transferred to the UK. So I moved with P&G to the UK at the time, and again, had a couple of really good years with P&G in the UK. And then an opportunity came to join a management consultancy business. The business was called Glendinning at the time, and it was a leading sort of sales and marketing consultancy business, particularly focused on mainly CPG type clients, but particularly in sales and marketing. And Glendinning had an interesting history. It originally started in the 60s and then sort of metamorphosized into really being based out of the UK. It was a small global business, but based out of the UK. And I joined primarily in a strategy consulting role and really enjoyed that. And then just after I joined, the business decided to look for an executive chairman. And at the time, we approached Martin Sorrell, who was obviously the founder and CEO of WPP, around joining us. And Martin's first job out of Harvard was at Glendinning. So he first started Glendinning and then went on to, you know, do various other things, including Saatchi, and then obviously founded WPP. You know, it was like one of those classic things where you said, you know, we need an executive chairman. And he said, I've got a better idea, I'll buy the company. And so that started my journey really in WPP and really into Kantar, where I've been for, you know, now well over 20 years. So that in itself was a brilliant learning exercise, you know, being part of selling a business to WPP, being through a process of an earnout at the time. And even though I was a relatively junior partner in the business, it was still a fantastic experience. And then seeing how we evolved that business post end of the earnout. And during that initial few years, WPP formed Kantar. And what Kantar originally was this holding company of WPP sort of research and consultancy assets that they'd acquired over the years. They had bought Millward Brown at the time, a business called Research International, and a few others. And they were sort of housed under WPP's sort of company at the time called Kantar. So we went into Kantar as a holding company, but we used to run very independently. It was in the time when WPP really ran its businesses as separate independent companies within this sort of holdco structure. So it was a great experience. And shortly after the end of the earnout, I was on the board at Glendinning, and the CEO of Kantar at the time, of the holding company, a guy called Eric Salomar, who I worked for many years, Eric approached me around a business we had in North America based out of Boston. It was a syndicated research business focused on sort of retail and CPG, and had not been doing well and sort of required a turnaround. And they just let go of the current CEO and were looking for someone to run that business. So I sort of on a whim picked up a suitcase on a Friday, flew to Boston and started on Monday morning, sort of walked in as a new CEO. And that was a hell of an experience. And I was young at the time. I was probably in my early 30s, probably about 34 years at the time. And it was my first, I would say, real leadership management role. And the business was called MVI. It was based out of Boston. Boston. It's now part of our broader Kantar family and consultancy parts of our businesses. I spent a number of years really working on turning that business around. So it was great business, great fun, new business model, syndicated primarily, obviously getting to know the US and getting to understand different cultures and getting to understand the way business is done in the US. So that was a really good experience. And then during that time when I was running that business, and it was quite a foundational change for Kantar, Kantar acquired a business called TNS. And that essentially doubled the size of the Kantar business at the time. Went from sort of roughly a $1.5 to $2 billion business to a sort of a $3 to $4 billion business. And I had the opportunity then to essentially consolidate all of the, at the time we called them sort of the retail and consultancy units within both now the combined Kantar and TNS. And there were five different companies that we brought together under a business called Kantar Retail. And I became the CEO of Kantar Retail and continued to do that job initially from the US, from carried on in Boston. And I was in Boston for almost 3 years and then moved back to the UK to run the business from the UK. And that business consisted of the Glendinning business I'd been at, the business I was running at the time, MVI, and three other acquisitions that had been made over the years between both TNS and Kantar. So we started then this process of moving from essentially a holdco into consolidating companies. And that's been, you know, I think a journey, honestly, we've been on for really for more than 10 years, which is really moving from this portfolio structure into an integrated company. And this really was the first step, was acquisition of TNS, started that process. And from that, Kantar really got going. We formed a board. I was part of the board of Kantar, and we've been on that steady process all along.
Just one of the things that struck me as you were talking there, and probably for anyone listening, they'll think either you were incredibly lucky that all these things kept popping up, or you were doing something that put you at the top of the list for the person that got chosen to go and do these great jobs. So if you wind that back to, I'm not from South Africa, so I can't imagine, but apartheid, Johannesburg, Cape Town, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking most people that were your age then that were graduates were joining African businesses, local businesses. You get this opportunity to go and join a global business as graduate number three. Was that very deliberate? You know, were you sort of sitting there thinking there must be a world outside Africa? Or was it just happen chance?
It's funny how these things are, and you sometimes at the time you don't think about it too much. When you reflect, you think about things differently. I definitely wanted to join a global business at the time. So when I was at university, you know, I looked around, and as anyone knows, anyone understands the history of South Africa, it's a wonderful country, but it has its challenges. And I wanted to make sure I was in an environment which gave me two options. One was to learn and really learn from a global business, and two was to give me options to work abroad. And at the time, I'll be honest with you, it wasn't to leave South Africa. My career has taken me really around the world, and my sort of base home is out of the UK. But it wasn't a deliberate time to say that I wanted to leave South Africa. It's actually my career has done that. But it really was to give me options from a personal point of view, but also to learn and be part of a global organization. And I'll remember very clearly when I targeted companies when I was at university, I targeted the likes of Procter, Unilever, some of the big strat consultancy companies like McKinsey and Accenture, and those businesses at the time, and P&G was the one that had the right fit. It was very much of a deliberate effort. And in most of my career moves, one of the things I've been focused on is this a good learning experience from both a personal and a professional point of view? And the things that I think have excited me is that they've been great learning experiences. You know, so you're going to go live and work in a different country in of itself outside of the role is just a wonderful learning experience. You grow and you learn culturally. You learn how to operate in different business environments. You learn how to work with different people. And some of it's serendipity. Opportunities come along and, you know, you're in the right place at the right time. Some of it's you've done a good job, so you've put yourself in the right position. But you've got to take those chances. And the one thing I have consistently done in my career is when opportunities have come along, I've typically gone yes. Generally say yes more than no. So it's always been good.
Well, you know, I'm fascinated by that. And maybe we come back to that as a point, because I think that part of what we're trying to achieve with this podcast series is sort of humanizing the concept of leadership, which sounds very grand, but all people at some point are faced with opportunities, choices. Correct. And actually talking to one of my other guests, she talked about feedback being a gift. And, you know, listening to your point there around that evolution of learning and even reflecting on my own career, I think at the point where you're most intellectually curious is where you're at your most valuable and most dangerous. Yep. And it's interesting. I mean, obviously I run a search business, but how many people hire someone based on their level of intellectual curiosity? Yes. Versus whether they've done that exact same job before?
So I think curiosity, it's one of the things I look for when I meet people and interview people. I think curiosity is really important. You know, even if someone's got lots of experience in the area that you're hiring them from, it's that they're curious to learn about a new business. And I think it really is an important element that's often overlooked when you hire people.
Sorry, because I jutted in right as you were in mid-flow. You were running Kantar Retail at the time and talking about consolidation. So, correct.
So after being in Boston for 3 years, I moved back to the UK, and at the time then moved from being the CEO of Kantar Retail actually into group, into what was now being formed, the sort of the Kantar Group, and took on this role of group chief client officer for the business. And I did that for a couple of reasons. One is I was in a specific part of Kantar, which was focused on the consulting and the retail CPG side of the business. And I wanted to get exposure to all of Kantar. And this is to our core brand businesses, our big creative businesses, our actual research businesses. So it was about getting exposure to that. And two, like in any professional services business, particularly, you know, even as we evolved over the years, but at our core, you know, we were a professional services business, was clients are very important. Clients are at the heart of our business. And we were in the process of really saying, how do we win with our largest clients? How do we build relationships which now cut across all of these different operating units? So we start to bring the Kantar story in a more coordinated and bringing the best of Kantar to clients. And they were asking for it at the time. And our largest clients, whether they be a Unilever, a Google, a Nestle, a VW, whoever it might be, they were increasingly saying, I'm dealing with different parts of the business. How do you start to bring this stuff together? And it was essentially a new role we had created as sort of group chief client officer. But for my sins, I decided to do that alongside some other roles. So I basically built what we now have as a actually very powerful sort of global client management structure. And that was the start of that process. But alongside that, I did a couple of roles through that period. So first of all, I ran a portfolio of companies. And at the time, that was the way we ran the business. We had sort of began this consolidation process, but we ran a portfolio of companies. So all of the consultancy units reported into me, and I was essentially the group Kantar leader across that portfolio. I also had, we had a business based out of India called IMRB, which was a business that worked across a number of multiples that also reported into me. So I was getting experience in the way WPP ran its businesses, which was this combination of portfolio alongside the group client officer role. And then a few years later, we went through a significant organizational change, which really is the basis of our business today. And we called it at the time Kantar First, and it was the first genuine integration of all of our businesses and essentially taking these individual companies and getting them into a integrated Kantar business. And we began to move away from companies to solution areas. We began to move away from what we were calling different companies into how do we service clients around their brand needs? How do we service them around what they want to do with innovation? How do we service them around what they do on the media side of the business? So we moved from a, let's call it a company structure, essentially to a solutions organization. And that was called, initially called Kantar First, which we kicked off in 2016. And I was very closely involved in that, setting that up. And then at the time, I also took on the role of leading our North American business. So after a few years in the UK, again, I picked up my bag and I swung back to the US and into New York this time and led our North American business for 3 years, and particularly seen the integration of that North American business, bringing all those different parts of Kantar together under a much more unified business. And again, that was a great experience. And I think one of the challenges of anyone who's led a large integration knows that the most important things in that is how you get people to work together, how you should never underestimate culture. And it's a well-known and maybe a hackneyed saying, but you know, culture trumps strategy every single time. And I think that's very, very true. So it was really about working through. And even though the businesses in some ways were quite similar, you would think two global research businesses like TNS and Millward Brown are fundamentally similar businesses. They had very different cultures in the way they operated and worked. They had actually quite different operating models. So really trying to make that work was really quite challenging. It was very exciting. It was quite tough at times. And we made a lot of tough calls in the way we had to bring those businesses together. But we are bearing the benefits and bearing the fruits of that now, you know, many years later as we've sort of integrated the business. But that process actually started at that point.
It's really interesting, that point there. And it always strikes me as fascinated with this, with lots of people who have worked in lots of different places, because I haven't. I've worked in a business and I've been to lots of different places and I run a global business. But, you know, the fact that you would pick up your suitcase and disappear off to New York or Boston or Singapore or, you know, wherever. So that's one thing. You've got the sort of geographical and international cultures, and then you've got the sub-brands. So there's cultures within cultures. What's your learning as to how you adapt to those different cultures and then how you integrate culture or create one culture? Because that's tricky.
It's tricky. And I don't know if there's a, despite what management consultants might tell us and what we might sometimes even tell our clients, I don't know if there's a playbook that works all the time and that is straightforward. But I guess a couple things. One is I do think you need to listen. You know, I think it's very important. I think you might have a clear plan around what you want to do and a clear idea about what you think an end state might be, but you do need to listen, and you need to listen to different voices across organizations. And I think that's really important. We were talking early on about curiosity. I think you have to have genuine curiosity, because I think the more curious you are, the more you understand about businesses. And there's these unintended consequences. So sometimes things look very good on paper, they make sense on a spreadsheet. You pull stuff together and you say, well, if we join these two teams, etc. But the dynamics of individuals are important. And, you know, some of our businesses are actually quite productized. So the impact of people is less so. Other parts of our business are very reliant on key individuals within that business. So how you manage it, how you bring people along is key. I think at some point when you are clear around what you want to do and you've taken all those points of view and you've got what you believe is the right plan, you then do need to execute that with real conviction. And there is a point, because in every organization, people agree to stuff, but then when that change happens, they don't. And, you know, being on the bus is important. And at some point, you need to say to folks, you're either on the bus or you're not on the bus. And maybe we're not the right organization for you, depending on what you want to do. And I think being willing to take those tough calls early and quickly is very important. And listen, I wouldn't say we've got it always right. I think we've made mistakes along the way, and some things we've done better than others. But over the years, I think as we've done more of this and we've been bringing the business more and more together, we've got more of that right than we've got wrong. And we've started to build a new culture. One of the things I think is very important is you need to, instead of saying we are bringing two or three different cultures or organizational approaches together, you need to say we're building something new. We're creating a new business, a new culture, a new way of being successful, and people need to buy into that. And I think particularly in the last 3 or 4 years, as we've transformed Kantar into private ownership, I think we've done a much better job about setting out what the businesses that we want to be and getting people excited about that. So there needs to be a clear vision and a go-to for folks going forward as well. But these things are difficult because you're dealing with individuals and people and their own careers and all of that sort of stuff. So sometimes it requires quite delicate handling and being willing to adapt your approach as you go as well.
Really useful. And your point there, I mean, we're skipping ahead a little bit, but the other fascinating point of clearly is that, you know, and I'm sure you'll explain how this all happened, but that point there around the spreadsheet might tell you one thing or the logic might tell you another thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you're now in private equity ownership.
Yeah.
So how have you meshed the culture with the numbers?
Yeah, no, and that's been a big change. So, just pull the story together. So after 3 years in North America, and folks might remember this, at the time, there was a change of leadership at WPP, and Martin exited the business. And as Mark took over, he needed to make some strategic choices around what he did. And one of them was to sell Kantar. But it was something which the management of Kantar were very supportive of, because WPP had a lot of competing priorities. And, you know, as a big multinational, they've got pressure on all of their businesses, whether it be their creative agency businesses, whether it be their media businesses, etc. And we needed to transform Kantar, and we needed something different. And in fact, we really needed investment as well. So as a management team, we were very supportive of the carve out and of the sale of the business, and went through a process. And again, it was something which, again, is a fascinating process, I think, in of itself, to go through meeting, you know, at the time, multiple private equity owners, and ultimately Bain Capital acquired our business in, at the end of 2019. And Bain have been great owners, you know, and I say that sort of hand on heart, not because they still own the business, but because they are genuinely interested in how the business works and operates. And one of the advantages of being in a private business is you can actually take a longer term view of the business. You can take a view over 3 or 4 years. And not to say that short term performance isn't key, it's absolutely critical, but you do take a longer term view. So we've been able to invest in the business. And then to your point, actually, it's a very interesting point around there's a discipline that we have brought into the business over the past few years under Bain Capital ownership, which has been really important to Kantar. And a lot of it has been around both financial discipline and operational discipline. And they are, as you can imagine, very financially focused, very clear on logic and spreadsheets and how things go. But the one thing I think, and I'm not saying this for all private equity companies, because I've only worked under Bain Capital, the one thing I think they understand that is very important is that strong leadership teams and a strong management group is absolutely critical to the success of a business. And they invest, and we have invested disproportionately in building our management and leadership, both in making changes and bringing new talent into the team, but also investing in that team. So investing in the development of that team, really focusing on how they work and operate, and really building very strong disciplines around the way we run the business. And I think that's been a real change for us over the past few years. And there's a strong belief in their business that culture is very important. You know, and as a private equity business, while they look at it from a distance, they do understand the importance of having a strong culture. And I think we have, over the last few years in particular, built a very strong culture in the business, particularly around our leadership group, around focusing on what's best for the business, having our objectives aligned. Our objectives are very well aligned with our owners. We're all moving in the same direction, wanting to achieve the same thing for the business. That's very important for us as well.
Well, and 2019, of course, was an interesting time to do a deal because there was a thing called COVID-19 that no one knew about then. And then it came rather quickly over the hill. Were you in New York then? Were you in New York or London? I can't remember.
So I just moved back to the UK about 6 months earlier. So I was back in the UK at that time. And obviously COVID, like every other business, it had a profound impact on the business. Trying to operate in that environment, you know, is incredibly challenging. We sit back and I think look at that period and I'm still amazed at how well we, and I know other companies, responded to it in terms of standing up the organization, continuing to be effective. And actually during that time period, when we were there, we simplified and reorganized the business. And we really moved from the sort of solution structure to sort of a geography and solution structure. And that's a core structure we have today, which is much, much more typical of how most businesses operate. So we have sort of our core P&L sit under our regions. And then we have our solution areas that sit across that. And within that, I was then asked to go lead our business in Asia Pac. And again, to the conversation actually we had earlier on, I'd never worked in Asia Pacific. I'd spent a lot of time there in various roles. I was still the group chief client officer and took this on in addition to that role as well. But I'd always wanted to go work in that part of the region. It's a very fast growing part of the world. It's a very important part. The world continues to shift east in many ways. And even with the changes of dynamics with China, it still remains very important. India, you know, be a massive part of the global economy in the future years. So just having the opportunity to work and lead that region for a number of years was great. And I had to do that job initially from London because of COVID. So I did have the joy of about 9 months of being like a DJ, like a late night DJ, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and having meetings and all that sort of stuff. So that was quite tough for a while, but eventually I had the opportunity and I moved out to Singapore and spent a couple of years in Singapore running that region. And again, very different cultures, different dynamics. At a time, actually, very interestingly, while the mood music, for example, in Europe and particularly in the UK was very negative. I mean, if people remember coming out of COVID with inflation spiked, you know, if you turned on the BBC or anything in the UK, it wasn't the most uplifting news you were getting. And obviously, the war in Ukraine kicked off as well. It is amazing when you're out in Singapore, a lot of that stuff really wasn't a factor at all. And people were very focused on growth. They were very focused on continuing to drive the economies. It was a very commercial mindset, much more upbeat. So it was a very different dynamic, I think, in that part of the world as well. So it was actually a great part of the world to be in. And we had very strong success in Asia for a couple of years. Our business in India in particular did incredibly well. We have a very strong business in that part of the world. And so that was great to be part of that. And again, that was now under Bain ownership. And we were driving, as I say, this much more disciplined, focused model. Going forward, we had begun to start to sell non-core parts of our business, really focus on our core. That's, I think, one of the things private equity is very strong at, is getting very focused on what is the core proposition of the business and then how do we double down on that. We started investing significantly in technology-enabled solutions. That's been a big part of our business going forward as well. So you had all these dynamics changing. You had change of ownership, COVID, change of geography, and a number of things happening at the same time. But, you know, as I said, it's been an incredible learning experience as well. You know, even well into your career, it's amazing how much you can still continue to learn and add value as well as you go along.
I remember talking to you in the middle of the pandemic, actually, and we were both debating over, you know, this kind of virtual existence that we were all sort of going through. And I can't remember what the conclusion of that was. Well, still, there isn't really a conclusion, is there? It's kind of an ongoing debate. But I remember talking about it. But I hadn't really thought about the fact that you were running a business in Asia Pac from London through screens, trying to understand cultures. And I mean, that is... I agree with your point. You know, whenever I travel, lucky enough to travel quite a bit in this role, often staying in hotels, wherever I am, I always read whatever the local paper is. And it does depress me being in the UK and reading our news versus being in Dubai, which, you know, where clearly the sun always shines, for want of a better phrase. But that must have been very, very difficult. I mean, how do you win the hearts and minds of an organization? Presumably you took on that role from someone else, there was changes needed. Like, how do you assimilate quickly? Or slowly? How do you do that?
It's tough. And under normal circumstances, you'd be on the ground. So you'd have a chance to meet people face to face. And now you're doing a lot of this stuff virtually. And as I say, I did it for 9 months before I had a chance to move there. And we did do it at the time through a major restructure. So as we moved to Bain, under Bain, this was one of the first big simplification and organizational changes that we made. So I was taken over from someone and we were consolidating and bringing together different parts of our business. I guess a couple of things. One is, I think you need to be empathetic and sincere, genuinely. And I mean, I know that's easy to say, but again, to the point, I think you need to listen to people, really understand what's on their minds and what's concerning them, both at an individual level. You've got to put hard yards in trying to speak to as many people as possible. And that is quite tough because you can surround yourself with maybe, you know, half a dozen of the key leaders and you get a perspective on the business. But you need to speak to many more people than that, I think, to really get an understanding of how people are feeling and how they're doing. You need to be very proactive in communication. So we spent a lot of time and effort, even online. And in some ways, the one advantage of the virtual environment was that there's an efficiency in being able to speak to people across that region. And the region's enormous. So you're going from India to Japan, down to Australia, to the Philippines, et cetera. So the ability to get out to a lot of people at different cohorts, whether it's a leadership group, the broader leadership group, or the whole organization. And we probably have across the region in all parts of our business, including our operations teams, probably 6,000 or 7,000 people. So you're trying to get to a lot of people and communicate a vision around what you're looking to do. I think the more you can humanize it, the better. So those are the sort of things that we've really focused on as well. And also, I think this is an important thing. I think our business, and I think most businesses like ours, are at their best when the organization is externally focused, when we are talking about our clients, when we are talking about our work, when we talk about what we're doing for clients and the impact of our work. That's when we're at our best. And the majority of people who work in our business, that's honestly why they come here. That's what they enjoy. They enjoy delivering great work, great insights, great impact for clients. And the danger with these changes is that the organization becomes very internally focused and everyone talks about the structure or the organization or the operating model. And while that's very important, I think really trying to drive that through and keep the organization externally focused. The one thing we did do, which was different, and it has pros and cons when we did this, we used external consultants more than we had done internally to drive some of that change. And it has pros and cons. In some ways, you can move quicker. And I think that has real benefit. In other cases, you need to be careful that the consultants don't drive the agenda. So how you manage the consultants in terms of how you land this with empathy, how you get the messaging right, how you bring the organization along, I think is important as well. But it did help, I think, move things quickly.
And Wayne, you're obviously back in New York now, and you've been at Kantar a long while in various different guises, in various different roles. And, you know, lots of others of that senior management team, it's been harder for them to stay within the business. There's been lots of change. What's kept you there so long? Like, how have you kept current? How have you kept forward looking? How have you kept being curious and learning?
There's a couple of things. One is, I must admit, I've really enjoyed and learned a lot under the change from public ownership to private ownership. And that, for me, has been, in of itself, just a fascinating learning. Everything is different, but I think that there's been a discipline and a way of running our business, which is more effective now, much more commercially focused and just much more tightened. I think there's been good learnings for that. It's also, I think, at a fundamental level, I had a real belief around the potential of Kantar and under public ownership, and I don't think this is an indictment of WPP at all. I think, as I say, they had competing priorities, but under public ownership, we weren't quite meeting our potential. We needed to invest in more areas and get really focused as a business. And I think we've done that and we are doing that at the moment under private ownership. And we have an independence. We run the business in many ways alongside Bain Capital. And that's been, honestly, that's been quite liberating in many ways. And I really believe the business is now building ourselves from being a good or very good business into a great business. And that's what we are genuinely focused on. So I'm very excited about the vision for the business, about what we are creating, and our ability to generally sort of build a great business. And for someone who's been in the business for such a long time, that is personally very important for me, that I can then look back and say, I've been part of this lovely journey and I've been part of this great journey and we've built a great business. I feel that I've been integral to building that great business. So for me, that's been an important part. The second part is you do need to adapt to a new world. And I've been effective at adapting to the way Bain see the world and the way they want leadership to respond. And then the third thing is, I think you need to take opportunities when they come, and those opportunities have arisen to take on new responsibilities. And I've gone, yeah, you know, I'd like to do that and I'm up for that. And I think that's been important as well. So those have been probably the key things that, you know, want to keep me motivated, but also made it clear to Bain that it's been important that I have a key role to play for the business. You know, we work well as a team with them.
Wayne, conscious of your time and so many learnings of what you said there, I think your point just a few moments ago about making an organization externally focused, and really within professional services firms generally, the power is in the talent you've got within your team and making sure, as you said earlier, there's a real focus around developing that capability, attracting, developing, retaining great people, and attracting, retaining, and developing great clients. And those two things are so interlinked. If you can't get the first bit right, you're never going to get the second bit right. And in this market where it's kind of fight or flight, whether that be politically, whether that be economically, you know, whatever people are looking at, but the great businesses or the good businesses are the ones that are able to put those two things, I think, right at the very heart. And given the fact that the topic of this podcast is really around kind of humanizing leadership, just lovely to hear words like empathy and sincerity and that approach to curiosity and learning and listening, actually. I think people who aren't running businesses think that people who are running businesses are the ones that tell everyone else what is happening. And it's like Jeremy Vine said, you know, he doesn't take to the news to the people anymore. The people take the news to him.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's really fascinating. Really enjoyed our time. I'm sure we'll get together when I'm next in New York or you're next in London. And I think we've spent much of our conversations talking about the respective fortunes of our South African and English rugby team. So it's actually great to cover that story all the way back to P&G. Thank you. I've really enjoyed that. And talk soon.
Thanks very much. And delighted to join you today, David. Very nice.
Take care. Cheers, Wayne.